This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
In this program, serial climate hacker Russ George's office is raided by the Canadian government. Nick Saul on taking food banks into a whole new level. How to feed citizens during tough times could be you. Then political scientist Dr. Martha Campbell from the University of California, Berkeley, explains why economists and women's advocates enabled the next population explosion. Why the big theory you've been taught doesn't work. I'm Alex. Welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Tonight on The Fifth Estate, he's been called a geo-vigilante, an eco-terrorist, a visionary who simply wants to save the world.
It's almost like putting a teaspoon of our multivitamin iron mineral. That's all the ocean needs to come back to health.
For years, American businessman Russ George has nurtured a controversial idea: fix global warming by seeding the ocean with iron.
We have a corporate mantra, and that is save the world, make a little money on the side.
But environmentalists are dead set against it.
We told him straight out if he attempted to do this project within the area near the Galapagos that we would physically intervene to stop him.
So how did the man who once sold the Vatican on a non-existent forest get away with it? Thumbing his nose at UN conventions and possibly Canadian law to carry out his grand experiment off BC's coast.
News broke of a massive project to try to absorb carbon.
Russ George dumped the iron to spark an artificial plankton bloom.
And how did he convince this impoverished Haida village to pay for it?
You're dealing with a man who primarily uses as his tools smoke and mirrors.
I honestly believe his work that he's doing is the right thing to do.
That's the trailer for the Canadian Broadcasting Fifth Estate program, The Iron Man, about Russ George and geoengineering, and Radio EcoShock is part of the story. I'm Alex Smith, and there are many big worries about geoengineering as an alleged solution to climate change. Since this program began, I've warned that a single individual, say a billionaire or a small group of people, could decide to change the climate for all of us. Regular listeners know this happened in a small way in the summer of 2012, as the unstoppable Russ George, formerly of Plankto's Corporation, led the West Coast Haida Nation into a plot to unilaterally dump 100 tons of iron dust into the Pacific Ocean off British Columbia, Canada. Now the Haida Salmon Restoration Corp offices have been raided by the Canadian government. The raid happened just 2 days before the Canadian broadcasting show Fifth Estate aired a documentary about this ocean dumping and the disappearing $2.5 million from the Haida Nation. Radio EcoShock has been part of this story since 2006. The CBC program called me during production and used some of my investigative journalism into this case of rogue climate hacking. In 2007, I ran an hour-long interview with Russ and another hour show with his critics. Along with George Watcher and investigative journalist Steve Krivet, we dug into the mysterious stock manipulation and promoters behind Plankto's Corp. That company went bankrupt, a disaster for the investors who were promised fabulous returns on the carbon credits Russ George promised would come from stimulating plankton with iron dust. Another Russ George turned up, almost like a physicist. He was claiming to be an expert and inventor in the controversial field of cold fusion. Once again, Russ George became CEO of a company which promised to revolutionize energy and heating, while saving the world, of course, by doing what had never been proven possible scientifically. I'm looking at a photo of the cold fusion furnace the company D2 Fusion promised to deliver to hungry stock investors. There was no furnace. That company went bankrupt. Are we seeing a pattern here? The question of fraud is so hard to prove, partly because it assumes the perpetrator knew a lie was being used for profit. But what if that person sees themselves as a well-intentioned visionary trying to save the environment using the capitalist system? What if he actually believes his own mythology? Find links to all my past coverage of the Russ George story, including audio of the full press conference held in Vancouver by the Haida Salmon Restoration Corporation in the fall of 2012, in my show blog at ecoshock.info. I presume the Russ George story was over with the double bankruptcy back in 2008, but he rose again. This time George used a relationship he built with the Aboriginal people of Haida Gwaii in the early 2000s. Again, it was a plot to sell carbon credits, this time by planting trees. That fell through. But Russ George apparently persuaded tribal leaders they could sequester carbon and make millions of dollars by seeding ocean plankton with algae again. This theory, unproven by at least a half dozen experiments done by real scientists aboard multi-governmental research ships, the theory was the algae bloom would sink to the bottom with its carbon. Not proven. Somehow the leadership of a tiny place in British Columbia called the Village of Old Masset cashed in previous government settlement money to raise $2.5 million for a new try in the Pacific. If the villagers were not sold on carbon credits, the story changed. Now they would be saving the dwindling salmon, returning the fishing industry to the many unemployed native people. In my Radio EcoShock show for October 12, 2012, I found a scientist who disputed the whole basis of the Russ George theory of plankton starving for iron dust or saving salmon. Russ George is not a scientist or even a university graduate, despite being called the chief scientist on last summer's ocean dumping experiment. Real Canadian scientists say there is no way to prove the latest claims. The Canadian government says Environment Canada advised the Haida Salmon Restoration Group not to try it. Now the government has raided the offices. Russ George complains about it in his blog. Quote, "Just days before Easter, our small village research office in Vancouver was swarmed by 11 officers dressed in all black combat gear, armed and imposing beyond belief. In the largest assault raid in Environment Canada's history, the raid team rushed into the office of seven people, counting the two grandfathers and two women present." End quote from Russ George at RussGeorge.net. What did he expect? After breaking the moratorium on such experiments, agreed by the London Dumping Convention, specifically after his previous attempts to capitalize on changing our oceans with the Plankton ship Weatherbird 2. Sadly, while George and the Haida may be charged with breaking environmental laws, I don't know, I don't expect any justice for the highly unemployed people of the village of Old Masset. There, $2.5 million has been taken by a serial dreamer and promoter named Russ George with the help of tribal leaders, including Mr. Disney. Watch out if you see Russ George coming again. It seems nothing but prison could stop Russ George in his mission to save the world while making money. He'll be back. But Russ George is a small-time operator compared to the multi-billion-dollar scams perpetrated on the ratepayers of Europe. They paid for carbon offsets under the World Bank Clean Development Mechanism to stop climate-damaging chemical plants in Asia that were never built, or built only to produce, or not produce, a certain powerful greenhouse gas. Nobody stopped that ripoff for years. They knew it was going on, and no one was ever charged. I'm sorry, but the whole plan for carbon offsets and carbon markets to make money just falls prey to human greed and self-delusion. We are carbon addicts who will say anything and believe it. The only true solution is to cut the drug off at its source, close down the tar sands, divert military spending and oil subsidies into clean energy, forget about coal, we must leave it in the ground. We must change our own lives going carbon free. Anything else is human fraud on a massive scale, setting us up for mass extinction. Stay tuned to Radio EcoShock. Find a link to the full CBC documentary by the Fifth Estate called The Iron Man at cbc.ca or in my show blog at ecoshock.info. Finding good food has become a kind of second job for all of us now, as the agribusiness and fast food empire serves up some deadly fare, and the leftovers from that giant food system go to our poorest people through the food banks. At least, that's the old model. How did food banks move from a stopgap measure to an acceptable solution? Can they evolve into a real self-sustaining food movement? Our guest Nick Saul has gone a long way down that road with an innovative food community in Toronto, Canada. With his wife, Andrea Curtis, Nick has just published the new book, The Stop, How the Fight for Good Food Transformed a Community and Inspired a Movement. Nick Saul, thank you so much for joining us on Radio EcoShock.
Thanks for having me.
Before we get into your projects in Canada, tell us how you learned what it's like to stand in a line waiting for food.
Well, I spent some time in my early years in Africa, and I was born in Tanzania. My parents were teaching at the University of East Africa. It was the socialist haven, Julius Nyerere, and so lots of people from all over the world who believed in socialism and greater democracy and equity went there. My parents did. So that had a huge impact on my life. But it wasn't until I went back to Mozambique when I was 15. My father and mother were invited to go teach at the university there. And Mozambique was in a very difficult time at that moment. The apartheid regime was alive and well in South Africa, and they did regular raids into Mozambique. So food, for example, was in short supply. And for a middle-class kid, although in a very progressive family, I still was a middle-class kid in Toronto. When I went to Mozambique, all those things I kind of took for granted went out the window, and everything from thinking that if you turned on a tap, water would come out, and in fact, it doesn't. It isn't always the case around the world. And food, I was responsible in part to do some of the shopping, and I remember vividly going to the markets, and there was very, very little food, and there might have been one or two things, and they were all the same at all the stalls. And bread and milk was rationed. So I remember clearly that was one of my jobs, was to go and wait in the bicha, which is line in Portuguese, to get our rations of milk and bread. And it was, I don't think I kind of understood it at the time, although there were always a few people who could get to the front of the line, and they were some of the diplomats, and they had a kind of self-entitled sense about themselves, and it angered me greatly, and I couldn't imagine what it did for others standing in that line, because the lines were long, and the fact that some people could walk to the front didn't go over so well. So I certainly had a more privileged position, given that I, you know, was living in a family that had some means in Mozambique, but they were difficult times, and that standing in a line stood with me. So when I eventually found my way to the Stop Community Food Center in Toronto, that was the first thing I really kind of reflected on, is the lineups winding around our back door waiting to get into the food bank. So yeah, that's a bit about that past.
Well, back in Toronto, you were hired to lead a food bank that had been, as so many operations have been, it was begun by the churches. Can you describe the kind of operation that you found there?
Yeah, well, I was hired as the, I guess, executive director of the STOP in 1998, and I didn't know a lot about food banks. I'd done a lot of community organizing in public housing, and I worked with homeless men, but it was my first exposure to kind of the food bank world, and it was a really difficult setting that I arrived in. I didn't quite know what to do at the beginning. It was a place where people kept their eyes on the ground, quite frankly. It was an embarrassing place in many ways. So the first thing that struck me was just the physical space. I mean, it was in a rundown building at the back of the building, and there was flickering fluorescent lights and kind of stained ceiling tiles and these kind of baffled dividers that at any moment were going to fall over onto someone. And I remembered also the chest freezers with electrical cords running all over the place, and I'll never forget the cockroaches and other things. So from a physical perspective, it wasn't very nice at all. And then the food itself was not healthy and not enough and not culturally appropriate, and of course the lineup. So it really was a situation where people who were desperate and really marginal were having to check their humanity at the door before they walked in. And I knew it was wrong from the minute I got there. And I guess the story of the book is about how it chronicles my 14 years at the Stop and how we reimagined that space into something that was much more about creating connection and community and dignity and respect. And that's been my travel for a long time around food.
Well, yes, Nick, you and your crew developed so many innovations, we practically need to start a list and work through them. Why don't we start with the community garden idea?
Well, I mean, I think the big thing in those early days in the late 90s was simply listening to our community. And we created lots of forums for that to happen, whether that was at evenings where we created a nice meal and people could come out and give feedback on how they were experiencing the organization. I had a lot of town halls, and we did a lot of one-on-one stuff to try to get a picture of what people actually wanted. And it was clear right from those early days that the food bank wasn't cutting it as it was constructed. And I think they spoke really clear that it wasn't reducing hunger, it wasn't improving their health. It certainly wasn't something that they felt very respected by. And so they said, we want to be engaged. We want to be involved. We want to be cooks. We want to be gardeners. We want to be able to speak about the issues that matter most in our lives. And we want to volunteer, et cetera. So, I mean, what we heard is that they simply didn't want to be passive recipients of food charity. And so from that, we just started to build programming that was more participatory and less stigmatizing. And the garden was an example of that. There was a park very close by, and they had this old bocce court, which is an Italian bowls game. And I guess they had built an indoor facility, and so it wasn't being used. And when we talked to the parks department, they said they didn't know what to do with it. So a few volunteers got together, and we built a beautiful 3,500-square-foot garden in the park. And it was amazing. When we were building it, people kind of came out of the woodworks to say, what are you doing? What are you going to grow? Can I help? And it just shifted the conversation away from a transaction, which is what the food bank experiences, toward building relationships, which I think ultimately has been the success of our work, is we don't think in terms of transactions. We think in terms of relationships and creating space where people can find themselves and be part of the solutions, whatever they may be. And the garden is a beautiful place for that to happen. I distinctly remember a Bangladeshi fellow. Toronto is a very multicultural community, and once the garden was up, he appeared at the food bank, and we had some of the food from the garden in the food bank, and he was very curious about a vegetable, and we encouraged him to come up to the garden, and he did, and he learned a bit about the various vegetables and fruits that grew in Toronto and could be grown, and he had come from an agricultural background, and so he went home with that information, and I think for him, he just did it on his balcony, maybe not his windows, I think his balcony, but that was the kind of thing that we wanted to be doing, is saying, hey, you know, you have some skills, we can nourish those skills, and the garden was a great space for that to happen, and remains a great place. It's not solving anyone's hunger, certainly improving some of the quality of food in our programs, but it's so much more than about growing food. It's about growing community.
And the book describes how you got inspiration from other groups in many parts of the world. What did you learn, for example, from the Northeast Neighborhood Alliance in Rochester, New York?
Well, I mean, I was excited to go there. I mean, I think we should step back a bit. In kind of in those early days, I didn't know much about community food security. And what was interesting is that there was a new kind of approach to how you work on food issues in low-income communities that was very integrated and prevention-focused and looked at issues and the way they were integrated between health and equity and the environment and community. So it was very exciting to start to see other groups starting to think along these integrated lines, because the food system, when you're looking at it from the perspective of a food banker, it's simply about getting any food to the person who walks in the door and gets to the front of the queue. And it doesn't really question issues of, well, where did it come from? How did it grow? Is this healthy? Et cetera. And, you know, I think our work is connected to this idea that food is imbued with culture and social and economic and environmental issues. So that was, I started to see that, for example, in Rochester, where there was work going on in the inner city. I think some of the grocery stores had disappeared, and there was a lot of work going on with youth to give them some business and economic training and growing their own food and selling it at the farmers market there. And so it just, was about growing food in the city, which is something we were trying to do at that time at the stop. But there was a sense that food is not just food. There's something else going on. And so it was exciting to see that, and it certainly was inspiring when I came back to Toronto to say, okay, how do we continue to motor along on this course?
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with author and food activist Nick Saul. We're talking about his book, written with his wife, and his life work, really, at The Stop, the food bank in Toronto, Canada, that became a whole food movement. Well, Nick, can you talk to us about developments in food and community building in Brazil?
Well, Brazil, I was there in 2004. We were invited down to their food and nutrition conference, and just the fact that it was called the Food and Nutrition Conference, in other words, they weren't just thinking about any food, they were thinking about good, healthy food, was a terrific experience for me. There was a president there, Lula, who, you know, got up at the opening ceremony and said, it is insane that some people eat five times a day and others go 5 days without food. And I was struck immediately by the political will that had been built to try and create something different in Brazil. I mean, huge poverty issues there. But, you know, I was coming from a context in which the crisis of hunger was not being viewed as a big issue and was being swept under the rug. And very rarely would you find a politician who would speak about it, and almost never would you find a politician who was in power, the governing party, talk about it at all. So to be down there and see politicians and civil society all coming together to say, how do we deliver on the right to food? And also the role of the state there was impressive in terms of setting up, they were called sacolau markets, which you had subsidized food in them, so purchased by the state from small farmers and purchased at full cost and then subsidized when they got into the markets. These wonderful spaces called restaurant populaires, where for a dollar or so you could walk in regardless of class and sit down and have a really good meal. So there were just a whole range of ways at going at food that linked people who were very vulnerable with also the production of food, and a very strong sense of how do we support farmers to stay on the land and grow sustainably, grow it close to where people live. And so that was built into the DNA of the politics of that time and remains so. Like if you go to Belo Horizonte, which is one of the kind of leading food cities that is very thoughtful about the role of the state and how it interacts with civil society. I mean, you can't leave that context without feeling, how do we get some of that where we live and how do we fight for that to ensure that, you know, food just isn't seen as something that one of the challenges that we're finding here in the North is that the good food revolution that is currently on, and I still think it's early adopters who are on it, it's led by the wallet. I mean, most folks who are able to participate in that new food economy, organic, et cetera, have dollars to do it. So how do we move from a consumer-led revolution to one that is about building food citizens, so that people are actually talking about how do we legislate ways that we all can participate in the good food revolution that is happening around us. And so whether that's ensuring that we have school nutrition programs or whether we're fighting to increase social assistance rates and minimum wages, et cetera, those are the things that I think are so key as we move away from just individualizing the issue into how do we make it about food citizenship. That is in part what's driving this movement of community food centers. We want to create spaces that build a big tent, get lots of people in it, and fight for the right to food so that if we say that sustainable food is the best food for our planet and our bodies, well, everyone should have access to that. And how are we going to get there? So, you know, Brazil was really helped clarify the importance of connecting with government and the state and trying to insert the conversation around inequity and unhealthy food into the state apparatus, as it were.
Well, you know, Canada is known as such a wealthy country. You have to wonder why Canada would need food banks at all. And then it seems like some of the more conservative politicians have almost been legislating policy. Does it seem that way to you?
Well, I mean, Canada is a very wealthy country, and it is an embarrassment that we have over 800 food banks from coast to coast to coast. I mean, even those who run the food banks would say that. It's certainly no answer to the issue of hunger. We have over 3 million Canadians who are food insecure, i.e., you know, they're not sure where their next meal is going to come from or they're missing meals so that their kids can eat. So there is huge levels of poverty in the city that I live in. 25% of people are below the poverty line. So it's a significant problem. And what we've basically said is on the food front, as our social infrastructure has deteriorated and we've had massive cutbacks in terms of that social infrastructure, that somehow the food banks are going to solve it. And so, as I've described earlier, they divide us as citizens. I think they create a bit of a moral release valve on government because they can point to them and say, well, look, the problem is being solved, when the truth is the most food insecure people in our country are those who use food banks. And then many people would never darken the door of a food bank because they feel embarrassed and stigmatized by the process. So believe me, there are, much like in the U.S., There are huge levels of poverty and so many people who are trying to make ends meet. And for our in our situation, I think in most places, the biggest cost in someone's wallet is housing. And so in the neighborhood that I work in, the vast majority of people spend their money on keeping a roof over their head. And I'll tell you, those roofs are not very pretty, basement apartments and very substandard housing. And yet they're spending a lot of money on that. And that's why 16,000 people a year go to the stop each year to try and get support with their food needs. So we do have a significant poverty issue, and our centers are in part to meet people where they're at with good, healthy food, but also to support them to see their issue within a systemic frame and saying, well, how are we going to fight for better housing? How are we going to fight for social assistance rates that allow us to live with dignity and health? How are we going to fight for a national housing program? I mean, those are the structural issues that we need to get at, and we want to support our community to speak out and lead on those issues. And it starts with a really good, respectful meal in many ways. There have been lots of examples of people who walk through our door who have started simply by eating a meal that's cooked with love, and they kind of recognize that love back in the food, and they look up and they say, wow, I can be involved in a community kitchen, or I can get involved in the garden, or my wife is pregnant, so how do we get into the perinatal health program? Or there's a workshop on housing rights, oh, I can go to that. Or there's a fresh market stand on Tuesdays, I'll go and I'll buy some of my produce from that market stand. Oh, there's a pizza oven on Tuesday evenings where we fire up the pizza and provide bowls of dough, and people can make their own pizzas and really just be outside and be together. So, you know, that's, I think, in speaking that way, is all about the power of food.
Well, right. You've got several really good solution type innovations that I want to get to in just a minute. But before we do that, do tell us about the experiment that you and your wife, Andrea Curtis, did trying to live on what the government says is just fine for the poor, the Do the Math Project and the Eat the Math Project.
Right. Well, the Do the Math Project or initiative was an attempt. It was all online, and we have here our welfare rates are extraordinarily low, and this was an attempt to highlight just how inadequate they are. And so people went online and they filled out what they thought they needed to have in order to live with some modest sense of health and dignity in our city, and they would fill in all of their needs, and lo and behold, they would get a number at the end, and it was usually in the range of about $1,500-$1,600 a month, and then it would flash what someone on social assistance, a single person on social assistance, would receive. And you know, when we did this, it was about $585 a month, and now it's, I think, about $600, so not a lot of money. So it was an attempt to get people conscious about how vulnerable people were. And our social assistance rates are kind of arbitrarily set. They're not set connected to, there's no rhyme or reason. It's all been a political football over the years. But the main takeaway is that they're extraordinarily low. So that was an important way just to get people talking and thinking from all corners about the inadequacy of social assistance rates here. And then the Eat the Math was an attempt to get people, we worked with about 10 or 15 prominent Torontonians who actually lived on a welfare diet that they picked up at the food bank. And look, I'm not poor, and I felt a bit concerned about doing it, but it was an eye-opener for me because we picked up a hamper, my wife and I. We decided, which imagine having the ability to decide that we're not going to include our kids on trying to survive on this hamper, but we did it just the two of us. And it was probably the most depressing, irritating, frustrating 5 days that you could possibly have. But I always knew that I could eject whenever I wanted. And of course, most people can't. And so for me, it was just a reminder, and I had worked on food justice issues on food justice issues for a long, long time. And just to go through that experience just, A, re-energized me for the fight to say it is insane that so many of our fellow citizens are not able to put good food on their table. And so that's what I took from it. But it was extraordinarily stressful and difficult, even knowing that whenever I wanted to, I could say enough is enough, which, as I said, is not the case for so many.
All right. Now, we're starting to run a little low on time, and I don't like that because we've got some good things still to talk about. So can we sort of get a nutshell view of three of your great projects? Let's start with the Green Barn. What's that?
Well, we opened it in 2008, and the Green Barn is a sustainable food production and education center, and we retrofitted a beautiful old transit barn into this center, and it's a place where we have a nice bake oven and outdoor gardens where we can do season extension growing, and we have a gorgeous kitchen. We do a lot of after-school programs with kids, and we've developed a curriculum that links with the Toronto District School Board's curriculum, so we have kids who come in four or five times over the course of the year to talk about food and culture, food and growing, food and cooking, food and equity. We have a beautiful 3,000 square foot greenhouse that is basically a big classroom, but it also grows quite a bit of our greens for our big meal programs. And so it's, again, it's just a place where people from all walks of life with a particular focus on low-income communities can be engaged with food. Now, the other things we do there, we do run a farmer's market, which kind of caters a bit more to the middle-class community that surrounds the Green Barn. But for us, that's also a chance to get them involved in the broader project of the stop, which is saying it's okay that you can afford and come to a farmer's market, but 2 kilometers down the road, which is where our main site is, there are so many people who aren't able to afford what's on offer here at the farmer's market. So join us in fighting for the kinds of issues I've already described, social assistance rates being increased, the minimum wage, et cetera. So it is a place that is focused on healthy food as it relates to the environment and community and justice. And it has kind of put us on a radar in a way that we weren't able to do in our much lower income neighborhood that we work at, which is only a few kilometers away, but it has created a platform for us to tell this broader story about how we are all connected and food does connect us.
So in 2012, you left your project, your baby, so to speak, the stop, for a new venture. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, I left to start a new national organization called Community Food Centers Canada, and we wrote a paper in 2010 that codified what we thought the community food center model was all about, and it also spoke to our aspirations to try and scale it across the country. We set up 2 pilots in Ontario that have gone really well and now are standalone community food centers. So that's the idea we're trying to, for lack of a better word, brand, the idea of a community food center. So in Stratford, Ontario, it's called the Local Community Food Center, and in Perth, up near Ottawa, it's called the Table Community Food Center. So we are in the process now of trying to raise money to create 15 of these centers across the country over the next 5 years. And on Monday this past, we just announced centers in Winnipeg, Manitoba, in Dartmouth, Nova Scotia, and another one here in Toronto. So the movement is on, and we're going to be obviously, like at the stop, tackling issues such as hunger and poverty, diet-related illness, social isolation, unsustainable agriculture. So there's a similar set of ways of doing that in each site, but each site will be unique to the landscape in which it arrives, and they'll all involve a quite lengthy community process to figure out what the best programs are to match the needs in that particular community. So that's the push right now, is to build out these centers that are, you know, adequately resourced, that have multidimensional food programming, are place-based, so there's kind of a physical place where all of this stuff happens. And I found that in my travels, so much of the nonprofit sector generally is under-resourced and ephemeral and barely hanging on. So we want to build centers that have staff and stable dollars and lots of volunteers, where there's a lot of things happening around food, including the advocacy that I've spoken about, that at the end of the day, we need to be talking about income issues. People aren't hungry because there isn't enough food. There's tons of food out there. In fact, we throw 40% of it away. So it's about distribution and it's about income. And we're not shy about saying that. Those are the things that need to change.
And it's about caring about people. So where can people find out more? Do you want to give us a website, a Facebook page, a blog, something?
The new organization, you can find information about it and perhaps sign up for a newsletter at www.cfccanada.ca. And we also have Twitter. So if you go to @aplaceforfood, You can follow us there, and you could like us on Facebook. But the website gives a lot of information about the model and how we find partners and some of the key areas of programming in each center. So I hope that's helpful to people.
Well, listeners, if you missed that, I'll put links to Nick's book and the blog in my own show blog at ecoshock.info. We've been talking with Nick Saul, co-author of the book, The Stop, How the Fight for Good Food Transformed a Community and Inspired a Movement. Don't think of this as a Canadian story, though it is that. I found the book has essential ideas for anybody in the Western world who wants to see food justice done. It's an inspiring story. Nick Saul, thank you for sharing with us and with the world.
Alex, thanks for your interest. I appreciate it.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. Please consider supporting Radio EcoShock. Find out more at our website, ecoshock.org. You can write me at any time. The address is radio@ecoshock.org. It is unthinkable that Ethiopia could double its population to 185 million people by 2050. But what if that does happen? Can anyone prevent it? We continue our series on population growth versus the fragile environment. Our guest is a political scientist who specializes in population. Dr. Martha Campbell lectures in the School of Public Health at the University of California, Berkeley. She founded and runs the nonprofit group Venture Strategies for Health and Development. Martha Campbell, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you very much.
I appreciate you joining this discussion. I found your essay in the new book, Life on the Brink, Environmentalists Confront Population, and reading your essay, Why the Silence on Population, and I think that's a key question, my jaw dropped by the second paragraph. You list some of the poorest nations, for example, Pakistan. As you say, it's just 20% larger than Texas. It's a desert-like country with just one major river for water. They had 41 million people when I was born, and now 185 million people. And unbelievably, by 2050, Pakistan is projected to have more people than the United States does now. To start with, Martha, who makes up these numbers and what are they based on?
Well, in fact, the numbers are put together by the Population Division of the United Nations. There are about 60 people, demographers, working on these elements of information, and they come from a lot of different sources. They come from sources from the countries themselves and just many different areas of expertise. They're pretty dependable. Sometimes they have to shift what they find, but on the whole, they're quite dependable.
Tell us about some of the other projected growth numbers that concern you and should worry us all.
Niger, as a matter of fact, in the north, and in fact the whole area of the Sahel, the country that is just from the west to the east of Africa and south of the Sahara Desert, the fertility is very, very high. But Niger has the highest birth rate in the world of 7.6 children on average. There is nothing that you can do take care of this situation unless you let women have the ability to manage whether and when to have a child. But this is in a society. What you have there is early marriage, and what you have there is also polygamy. And young girls are often married to much older men, and they don't have any other choices. This is the kind of thing that you need to be able to manage. Those populations are going to go from 5 million just a few years ago up to, something like 300 million people by 2050. And these are really astonishing numbers, but it's a great concern.
Well, as I said to the American environmental activist Dave Foreman, many of us can't hear those numbers as a reality. We have an automatic turn-off kind of denial machine that says it just won't happen. Instead of a Deus ex machina where some good force intervenes, we presume a kind of salvation by a devil like plague or starvation. So what about you, Martha? Do you think some of this population growth that's been predicted might actually happen?
Yes. The growth is going to happen very, very rapidly. There is no way around that. Many people will die, but many, many more people will have large numbers of children and will grow a lot faster than the kinds of deaths that have been projected.
Okay. Well, now you give lectures to students about population problems. How do they take it? Is it real to them?
The students take it very well, and in fact, they're fascinated, and they come to our classes religiously, and they are learning more and more. And then a lot of them want to come and work with us, as a matter of fact, at Berkeley. to figure out what it is that we can do.
Well, news articles, as you know, say the fertility rates are dropping in many countries. The United Nations has told us over and over again the population will level off somewhere around 9 billion people. Aren't we given the impression this problem is solving itself?
Yes, and in fact, economists have often said that the problem is going to solve itself, and they're really, really wrong. For a long time, in fact, for over a decade, the UN was saying that we're going to level off at 9 billion people. And finally, they changed it, and now they've said that it's likely to be more like 10.1 billion people at least by the year 2100. What they were doing was building in assumptions that there would be extra efforts. I've spent a lot of time in the UN. And one of the times that I talked with the chief demographer having to do with fertility, I said, why are you still telling the press, telling everybody that this is going to level off at 9 billion people? Because if you do that, nobody's going to put any extra effort into it. And the answer was, oh, we've built the extra effort into our assumptions. And I just couldn't believe it. And now I think they're doing it again. Even though I have friends in the UN, I do think that they're assuming that the public is going to actually take this on and run with it and make it happen rather than just watch happening.
Well, that's very interesting because that's exactly what the climate scientists were doing at the UN when they were saying, well, we've made these projections, but it's based on people giving up oil and people taking a lot of social action, and that hasn't happened. So we have a parallel there. Now, we should talk about the reasons for social silence on population in Western countries, in the media, and in green movements. You called it a perfect storm. Can you explain that? Just give us the overall picture of some of those forces.
Yes, the silence around population has been interesting because there are so many factors behind it. And some of them more important than others. And one of them is the visibility of a decline in birth rates around much of the world. And by the way, the poorest 40 countries or so are growing very fast. So we do see the decline on the whole. But when you have many more people increasing, you still have a huge problem. The second one is that conservative political and religious forces really prefer not to talk about it. So that's part of the silence right there. This is a matter of patriarchy, as a matter of fact. The tragedy of AIDS has dominated national health concerns. And so a lot of attention has gone to AIDS. The AIDS people have actually done very, very good publicity in getting people to understand the importance of this. This has drawn attention away. A lot of people think, oh, AIDS is going to take care of it. We think, that's terrible. We don't want this to happen because of AIDS. And besides, the AIDS is just a drop in the bucket compared to the rapid population growth in the whole world. There's a fourth one, and that is there is well-justified attention to consumption on the environment. And so a lot of people say, well, consumption is a lot more of a problem than population growth. But it is, in fact, if you can't do anything about the population factor, everything you try to do about the environment is going to be wiped away. And fifth, women's advocacy groups in 1994 made it politically incorrect to talk about population or family planning. This, I think, is the biggest silence of all. So a vast number of people were indoctrinated around 1992, actually to 94, to believe that family planning has been mainly coercive, which is not correct, and population is all about coercion. A lot of people still believe this, and for this reason, the environmentalists are silent on this too. And the last one, finally, is all of this is based on a long-held theory called the demographic transition theory, which we know now is not justified. There are many demographers and most economists believe that the only way you can slow population growth is by coercive birth control, which is very, very sad because it's not correct, but it means everybody feels you can't talk about it anymore. So it's been silent for almost 20 years. We picked up on this in about the last 2 years. People are beginning to talk about it more. And some of the media are too, and we're very glad to see that. But we have to move faster.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with Dr. Martha Campbell, a lecturer and director for International Population Dialogue at the School of Public Health, University of California, Berkeley. Martha, we've just seen the election of yet another very conservative pope in the Catholic Church. The regime of fighting any kind of contraception or family planning lives on at the Vatican and in so many American evangelical churches. How do you rate the effect of religion in the continuing growth of the human species?
I think religion, unfortunately, and these religions, conservative ones, are doing huge, huge damage. How many women have died because they have many more children than they wanted to have and they're unable to get birth control if they want it, and most women do want it. It really is about patriarchy. It's about keeping control of women. And I think that a lot of people have ignored it. In the North, they have. 98% of Catholics in the United States have used contraception one way or another. Well, most of Europe has simply sloughed off the whole subject, but many parts of the world are covered with beliefs in the Catholic Church, for example. In the other parts of the world, a lot of people take this seriously and feel that they shouldn't use contraception. In the meantime, however, as the World Health Organization has pointed out, 6 million women every year in Africa have unsafe abortions. 26,000 of them die, and multiples of those 26,000 are injured for the rest of their lives. So women feel they can't use contraception, but in desperation they find terrible, terrible means for stopping a pregnancy. And the huge, huge damage that this causes is just outrageous.
This is a super serious issue, but I have to ask you about your new paper, and it's titled, Do Economists Have Frequent Sex? Can you tell us about that?
Yes, a number of our friends in several universities and all are laughing about this. Well, we have recognized that we do know that all around the world, human beings across societies worldwide, unlike most other mammals, have sex hundreds or even thousands of times more frequently than is necessary to conceive a number of pregnancies that they want. So unless women have the knowledge and the means to separate sex from childbearing, their default position is really a large family. They don't have any choices. And in many countries, women still live in the depths of poverty. Very often they're treated as property, and they have little access to contraception. There are many barriers to that. And a woman who does not have enough power to tell her husband no sex tonight, you know, or unless he treat her roughly or take on another wife or another girlfriend, it leaves her and her children with less food. Economists believe, on the whole, that if you have more wealth and more education, then somehow couples will find a way to have smaller family. They'll find a way to manage their childbearing. But they don't seem to recognize that couples have frequent sex all around the world. Several years ago, we came to realize that most economists might not be aware that couples everywhere have sex frequently. So in jest, we then began to propose to our graduate students that the only explanation that we could think of where economists seem not to be aware of this common pattern is that maybe economists don't have frequent sex. So this is all done in jest in a very serious paper. It's only that part of it, then the title of it, that is funny, because it really does describe the situation that we're in, where the economists don't understand. It has got some attention. We haven't yet sent it into the World Bank, but we're going to do that. I think they'll be laughing, too.
It's pretty tiresome, though, to hear so many men who are well-educated who just don't get it when it comes to the choices that face most of the women of the world, would you say?
Yes, I think that's right. I think patriarchy is a very normal thing. It has ended in a number of countries, starting with Scandinavia, of course, in the past. But also, it is very natural, I think, for men to want to keep control of women. And this is an evolutionary thing. They don't recognize it themselves, necessarily. But it is since time immemorial, men have always wanted to control women. And you can think about the reason for this is they really would like to know whose babies that their women are carrying. And yet they will also sort of hold on to this kind of situation or hold on to this behavior for a long time, and it covers a lot of things other than reproduction.
Well, Martha, why do you think environmentalists are ducking the population issue?
The reason for the environmentalists to be silent on this issue and for whole environmental organizations to be silent on this issue is that they are afraid of the subject. They have been taught, they've been indoctrinated too, as have women's groups by certain groups of women who organized this in 1994, that if in fact you talk about population, if you try to reduce fertility, then that's telling people what to do. Whereas we know that family planning should be about letting women have options, not about telling people what to do at all. I was in the United Nations at the time, just before the Cairo conference in 1994, when the women's groups who decided to do this made a statement saying that we must separate in this upcoming meeting as it was going to take place in Cairo, that we must not keep together environment and population in the same conference at all. We need to keep them separate. That was a very, very strange thing to do. But at the same time, that information got out that we must not talk about population anymore. We must not talk about family planning. Instead, we have to talk about reproductive health. And this has put a great deal of fear into the organizations around the environment.
Well, it seems pretty obvious to me that women's rights and the population problem are tied tightly together. If the human herd is already overwhelming nature, can we escape the conclusion that environmentalists are going to have to become champions of women's rights around the world as well?
You are absolutely right. Absolutely right. As a matter of fact, I don't know if I told you before, I used to work in the Packard Foundation, the David and Lucille Packard Foundation in Los Altos, California, and had the privilege of heading the population program, which was also including reproductive rights. We've been with reproductive rights all along. And yes, when women have the ability to manage whether and when to have a child, then in fact the birth rates decline and the families are healthier, the women are healthier. It's possible to get education. It's possible to develop. And those things have to, in fact, be in place and let women have options before a lot of the development or the education can actually take place in countries which have low resources and are stuck right now, unable to develop.
Well, you know, Martha, Greens are not going to want to hear that. We have plenty of problems to work with already, nuclear reactors and oil leaks and the climate problem. But on the other hand, we want to save the Amazon, even though part of the pressure on the Amazon and on forests around the world is just more and more people who need a place to farm and to live and to make a living. So what happens if we don't confront this, if Greenpeace and Sierra Club and Friends of Earth just stay out of the population issue? What happens?
I think what happens is that people will suffer more, and they don't recognize this. It's hard for people to think in terms of big numbers. I happen to be a math person. I was ever since I was a child, and I saw a graph on population when I was 11 years old, and it really stuck with me. But I didn't want to become a demographer later on. I wanted to instead pay attention to how do we get people to get this? How do we get people to understand this when people generally don't understand big numbers? I don't know why they think that the world can keep going and going at levels of consumption and levels of population growth without having some huge difficulty, as you say, in the Amazon. And so my answer to them is no, population is not the only thing I think about. By all means, there are many, many factors. There are, for example, in our societies with great difficulty, the issues of corruption. There are issues of health. There are issues of environment. There are many things going on. It's just that there is also the population factor. It is only one factor. It just happens to be critical, attached to nearly everything else that you do.
Right. And you've written a new paper, something about freedom. Could you tell us about that?
Yes. We've written a paper called The Impact of Freedom on Fertility Decline. And what we're showing is that the theories behind fertility decline, which are widely meant to show that when people are healthier and educated and when people have more wealth, then birth rates will come down. We say that's not possible. It doesn't work that way. As a matter of fact, when you have high fertility in a country, the educational systems can't catch up with the need. And when you have high fertility, that is like four or five children or many, many more, then on average in a country, those poor countries can never develop. And the education can't happen until the birth rates come down. And then you need to do that. You have to be able to let women have the ability to manage whether and when to have a child.
And I think in response to what you said, it sounds to me like we've got the whole theory of population standing on its head. I mean, I've heard we need to have more education and more development, and then population will take care of itself. And you seem to be saying, no, 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 that's backwards.
Yes, as a matter of fact, John May, recently retired from the World Bank, who is now in the Population Reference Bureau, has pointed out in a meeting here at Berkeley that all countries that have five children or more have never, ever developed. And we have pointed out several years ago that we can't find any country that has gotten out of poverty while maintaining high fertility. And some economists have asked me, you know, wait a minute, where are your numbers on that? And I say, we've got our numbers. Our numbers are zero. We can't find any, except for, of course, a few oil-rich states. They're different from the rest, completely different. But on the whole, you just can't achieve it. When people talk about educating people or educating women and birth rates will decline, they're overlooking something. When you have a large average family size in a country, then what happens is that means you have many more children being born each year than the year before. And so in those countries, the governments cannot possibly keep up with the needs of the health systems in a country when you have many, many more children born each year than the year before. It's not possible. However, it is true that when people are educated, birth rates will come down. The problem is that most people will not get that education, and the group of people in those, or percentage of people in those countries who are not education will grow and grow and grow. This is not development.
Now, Martha Campbell, is there something that I've missed that you would like to talk about?
I'd like to talk about, again, going back to the impact of freedom, that since it's not really been understood by a lot of people that you just let women have options and bring first birth rates down, that you need to be able to understand that this means you need to let women make choices and women make decisions. You need to let girls go to school and have more schooling, and rather than having a baby at the age of 12, 13, 14, is as in parts of Africa, in fact, as in Afghanistan, for example. The Department of Defense already has picked up on the understanding that population growth and rapid population growth can lead to a lot of lack of security in terms of just violence around the world. A number of the people who were very, very active in women's advocacy groups, the problem was moving the family planning money out of foreign aid and into other things, in fact, didn't help at all. It just made the women poorer and poorer. And it helped in some small parts of the world, but it never worked on a large scale. Scale is very, very important here. And helping women on a large scale requires broadcasting with correct information, making sure there are enough contraceptives for people who want it, letting women have options, changing culture. That's another piece. I would like to talk about culture for a moment. Whenever I join a new class and get involved in a new class at Berkeley, I ask the students, how many of you have learned in sociology or anthropology that you mustn't interfere with culture? And about a third of the class raises their hand, always. And I say, well, let's rethink this. Let's think about it now, because there are different sides to culture. Culture means beautiful music. It means what people wear, what people eat, certain kinds of traditions that can be very nice. That's benign. Then there's this other piece of culture, which is very often there, called let's keep control of women. And I say, I think that it is fair to say let's upset culture. Nafi Sadiq, the Pakistani physician who ran the United Nations Population Fund from 1987 to year 2000, is still very active asking governments, wait a minute, what about these values you don't want us to interfere with and you call it culture? Have women written these values or did you men write these values? And is this about keeping control of women and don't you think you should rethink this? She's a real champion on this, and I think it's extremely important to recognize that we can talk about culture and say it's got a problem. When there are problems in a culture, we don't have to say. We have to leave it alone. We can criticize it. This goes along with the religion also. And that when religious forces actually harm women and harm families and harm the future of this planet, I think we ought to think very, very seriously about what's good about religion and what's really, really bad. So these are things on my mind, and I hope this is useful for you.
It's very useful for me, and I'm glad that you're willing to break the silence. You've been listening to Martha Campbell. She's the founder and president of the nonprofit group Venture Strategies for Health and Development. She's based in Berkeley. She lectures and writes about the coming storm surge, I would call it, of new human beings on Earth and what we could do about it. Check out her essay in the book Life on the Brink, Environmentalists Confront Overpopulation, from the University of Georgia Press. And find more links to Martha's work in my show blog at EcoShock.info. Martha Campbell, thank you so much for breaking the comfortable silence.
Alex, may I add of where people can get these two papers, and it's in the Bixby Center for Population Health and Sustainability at the University of California at Berkeley. And the way they can get these two papers, and that is the impact of freedom on fertility decline, and also do economists have frequent sex, they can find this under publications in Bixby, that's B-I-X-B-Y, .berkeley.edu.
Thank you so much. I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. That's it for this week. Find all our past programs as free MP3 downloads at ecoshock.org. Check out the weekly show blog at ecoshock.info for all the links. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for listening, and please join us again next week.